Good morning, everyone.
Would everyone kindly shut off and shut their mobile?
We're reading in Canto 4, Kingdoms of the Little Life, and I'm told that we stopped at the bottom of page 133 in the evolution of life, the development of senses, and the very primitive forms of life. So far, in the life evolution, thought was withheld, and nothing now she knew, but all the unknown was hers to feel and clasp. So this first expression of consciousness, it is through the senses. Page 134 at the top, we'll start reading from there. Patty, would you start?
Obeying the push of unborn things towards birth, out of her seal of insentient life she grew. In her substance of unthinking mute soul strength that cannot utter what is death divine, awoke a blind necessity to know. The chain that bound her, she made her instrument. Instinct was hers, the chrysalis of truth. And effort and growth and striving nations, inflicting on the body desire and hope, imposing on inconscience, consciousness. She brought into matter's dull tenacity her anguished claim to her lost sovereign life, her tireless search, her vexed, uneasy heart, her wandering, unsure steps, her cry for change. Adorer of a joy without a name, in her obscure cathedral of delight, to dim dwarf gods she offers secret rites, but vain unending is the sacrifice. The priest and ignorant mage, who only makes futile mutations in the altar's plan, and casts blind hopes into a powerless flame.
Thank you. So she, this is the life force awakening. Anybody would like to ask or share anything about this passage? Sorry?
What is a chrysalis?
A chrysalis is a stage in the development of an insect. There's the egg, and then the chrysalis stage comes, and then there's a pupa.
Butterfly comes from chrysalis.
Why is Don shaking his head?
It's not only butterflies.
No, it's insects in general, but perhaps we are most familiar with butterflies. No, there's an egg, and then the caterpillar hatches, and then the caterpillar makes itself a cocoon, and only then yes. So I think the caterpillar is the chrysalis form of the butterfly. No?
The hard shell.
The hard shell, the cocoon.
The cocoon is the chrysalis? Cocoon is made of silk. The caterpillar, with its silk, it makes itself a cocoon. And the amazing thing about that cocoon is, if you cut it open, there's no form inside. It's just liquid. But that liquid contains all the information for producing a beautiful butterfly. Amazing.
So,
wasps also make cocoons. They lay eggs.
They mix it with mud and clay. Yes. They are very hard, actually.
Yes.
They're not hanging, they stick to one place.
But those are somehow the protective structures which they make to keep their eggs inside. And when the eggs hatch, then they're like little grubs, no? And from those the mature wasps emerge. So these are amazing processes of life. And here he says, this is how life breaks out of its seal of insentient life. There's a period in the development of life when there are no senses, but this appearance of sense is extremely important, because that is the way in which the consciousness begins to be able to express itself. So the being has a substance of mute, unthinking soul strength, but that has no means of expression. It cannot utter what its depths divine. There's a kind of knowledge in the depths of what must be. But that's not it's not thought out, it's not known, can't be expressed. But in that state wakes up a blind necessity to know. That need to know is there in the little being from the very beginning. Yeah, we should always wait until 10:45 to start. But we've resolved that we want to try and start always at 10:30. Ah. It's all right. It's all right. We're on page 134.
Already in the first line, I think it's so amazing. Yeah?
Yes.
Weighing the push of Angon since God's
towards birth. Yes. That's the push of evolution from the very beginning. Mm.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm not hearing you proper now.
The first word, obeying, in that sentence.
Yes.
Sentence,
yes.
Obeying from which, whose order, whose urge?
This is life obeys the evolutionary push of unborn things, of things that exist in potential, towards birth, towards being born.
Evolution, evolutionary forces.
Yes. So the next step in that development for life is breaking out of this sealed state of insentient, of having no senses, no capacity to feel. But because that push to knowledge is there, that wakes up this blind necessity to know. And so she makes use of the chain that bound her. The matter, no? We read in the last canto, no? About how the whole wonderful descending life principle got swallowed up and imprisoned in matter. No? So that's she's as if bound with a chain of matter. No? But she makes use of that instrument, and she's got this power of instinct. Instinct is the expression of true knowledge in unthinking things, maybe insentient things even. They don't think out, or there's that innate knowledge. We could say in a way it's the knowledge of the species that drives them. Instinct was hers, the chrysalis of truth. We can say the first formative stage of truth. And she can make an effort. There's some energy and growth and this striving nescience, this state of not knowing, which wants to know, which has this blind necessity to know. So this is in us even. This inflicts on the body the feelings that we experience as desire and hope. It's this that imposes on unconscious things the urge towards consciousness. So in this way, the life force brought into matter's dull tenacity, matter holding on to its inertia and its nescience. No? Life, she's imprisoned in that, but she brings into matter her anguished claim to her lost sovereign right, her longing for bliss. Bliss is her sovereign right that she has lost in this fall into matter. No? Everything in us Sri Aurobindo says, our very senses yearn for bliss. That's what life brings into matter, something that wasn't there at all. There had been this harmony of inertia. So her tireless search, life cannot help constantly searching for new things. And that gives her her vexed, uneasy heart. She's always troubled and dissatisfied because whatever she can grasp through the senses, through matter, is unsatisfactory. It's not yet bliss. No? This brings about this state of wandering, unsure steps, always looking for something new. No? Her cry for change. This urge that is in the life force, always for something new and different. It's constant dissatisfaction. And then comes this amazing image of Sri Aurobindo for this state. Dhanalakshmi. Sorry? We read it last week, I know. Let's read it again. We read it just now, Adora of a Joy. Sorry. Because we read it last week, I didn't notice that we read it again. And we saw it on the screen, didn't we? So anybody would like to ask or say anything about this image? Yes.
In a jungle, the modern mother said, instinct is the first to come out alive.
Yes. I think Sri Aurobindo says something similar. Like, we can trace at every step of evolution, we can trace the presence of the supramental. We can find it in minerals, the way that minerals and completely inorganic matter organizes its molecules, its atoms, as the action of the supramental. And in life, it expresses itself as instinct, the knowledge.
And also, can we read sense, supramental sense?
There is a that will be when we become supramentalized. We will experience the supramental sense, which means experiencing the presence and the delight of the divine everywhere, always, in everything.
Yeah. But some part may be touched with the veil.
We may be touched by that.
Is not really.
So this stage now, that supramental sense is not there. There's this first fumbling physical senses. No. Yes, so this image of... Sorry?
What are these big rock gods?
You haven't any idea, Bhuvana?
Life gods?
Yeah, they're the little lower life gods. He speaks about the nether gods. No. They are divine powers, but they have a very limited range of responsibility and expression. Dim, dwarf gods, very small scale. I think we see images of them in some of our South Indian temples. There are these little ganas. These are these dim, dwarf gods. And at the feet of Lord Shiva, they are so happy. They sing and they dance. And in one of his New Year's musics, Sunilda has expressed the dance of those little gods. Sri Aurobindo mentions it, I think, in Book 7, Canto 5, where Savitri experiences the descent of the mother into all the chakras. And then are those little gods. There's a happy romp of little gods in time. So we can see them around the base of some of these South Indian Shiva temples. There they are, so happily romping and singing and dancing.
And what does he mean with she offers sacred rice to them?
Yes, so this is a reference. We will come again and again to Sri Aurobindo's references to the process of sacrifice, which is very, very, the way he sees sacrifice is very different from the connotation that we in the Christian West have of sacrifice as something difficult and painful. Well, maybe sometimes it is difficult and painful, but he sees sacrifice as the universal process of interchange by which the evolution moves forward. The lower levels sacrifice to the higher levels, and even more powerful is the sacrifice of the higher powers to the lower ones, which we shall read about a little further on in this canto. So all of us, all the time, we are sacrificing in one way or another. We are participating in this interchange, and we are receiving something in return for our self-offering, the offering of our energies. But he says at this point in evolution, the offering that the life forces can make is very unconscious. There's no real knowledge there. And so the life goddess is worshipping dim dwarf gods, little life energies. No? But where she makes her offering is a cathedral of delight. She's always worshipping delight. But this is an obscure cathedral. It's not illumined with any higher knowledge. So she's offering these secret rituals, hoping for blessings, no? But vain, unending is the sacrifice, because the priest, the one who's in charge of doing the offering, is an ignorant mage. He's ignorant and he's just doing some kind of magic, some spells, without knowing their significance. He doesn't know how to make a truly conscious offering. So all he can do is to make futile mutations in the altar's plan. It means on the altar where the sacrifice is to be made, there are certain ritual objects, and if we make the sacrifice rightly, Mother has written about this, spoken about this amazingly in the agenda. If we just knew how to make every little physical detail with full consciousness, that would be such a powerful sacrifice. No? But he doesn't know how to do that. So like us, he's just making futile mutations in the altar's plan, shifting things around and not making things better. No? And he's offering something into the flame of sacrifice. There's always a flame of aspiration and purification into which we make our offerings. But these are blind hopes. He just, you know, our blind hopes. We hope against hope that things will get better, but we have no basis for that, no idea how to make it happen.
It's interesting that he's putting it in the early beginnings of life.
Yes.
And somehow relating to our offering also.
Well, we can make a parallel, no? Because this sacrifice happens at every level of existence, from the lowest to the highest. This process is going on, no? And it's the very process by which the world moves forward. So we can make a parallel. We can see how difficult it is in those first stages of life. There's no knowledge. The only guidance is the senses and the instinct. So for the life goddess, this is a very poignant stage, if we think about the divine bliss, which is her native home and her sovereign right. How she's struggling to reach that. Yes, Lyuba.
The word mutation is very interesting because it's not only change, but from the biological point of view, life and new species, they come through mutation. rotation of genes and all like that. So that kind of also hints to the biological process.
Yeah, but those biological processes, many of them are futile, no?
Yes, exactly. She's trying.
She's trying out different alternatives. Yes, yes. Yes. So that flame has no power because there's no knowledge behind it. Sorry? Well, you've seen an altar in a church, for instance. There are certain objects there, and they have to be handled in the right way in order for the sacrifice, the offering, to be valid. So in the Vedic sacrifice, it was similar, you know, what had to be done, when, at what moment, and how. And I don't know anything about it at all, from that point of view.
Some of them are not futile, these sacrifices. Some of them may claim to go up. All 100% of them are not futile.
No, in our sacrifices, if there's a little bit of true aspiration, then of course it has its effect. Maybe even these futile mutations have their effect somehow. But as I said last time, if I look around at the world around me, I see a lot of ignorant attempts to improve things, which only bring about futile mutations. Anyway. The ignorant mage.
Yeah, ignorantly just striving for something
and not knowing.
Being futile in some way, what is there being, what for what reason?
Yes, just hopes.
Of the mind. Mm. Yeah.
Blind hopes, yeah.
It's a preparation of ignorance.
Yes, that's what he's going to show us. That all this is a preparation. It's not totally futile. Yeah. So let's read on. Dana.
The burden of transient gains weighs down the steps, and the body under that load can she advance. But the hours cry to her, she travels on, passing from thought to thought, from one to one. Her greatest progress is a deepened need. Matter dissatisfies, she turns to mind. She conquers earth, her field, then climbs the heavens. Insensible, breaking the work she has done, the stumbling ages over her labor pass. But still, no great transforming light came down, and no revealing capture touched her fall. Only a glimmer sometimes splits minds.
It's so poignant, no? There are some gains from her sacrifice, transient, impermanent gains, but they are a kind of load she has to carry with her. They weigh down her steps so that she can hardly move forward because of those things that she's gained, that she's established. She can hardly advance, but she has to go on. The hours cry to her. She travels on, and she passes from one idea to another idea, from one longing to another longing. Her greatest progress is a deepened need. I think this is true of all of us. When Savitri meets the Madonna of Light in Book 7, Canto 4, she tells her, it's no use pouring down intuition, higher consciousness, all that on human beings. They will just think it's their own virtue, and they will sink down under a weight of spiritual ego. What you have to do is to intensify the human need for eternity and infinity. That's your task. Our greatest progress is a deepened need, a sense, an instinctive sense of what we most need and most lack. So he mentions the steps. Matter is unsatisfying. She does turn to mind. We shall read about those developments soon. She conquers earth, the material world, her field, and then she turns to higher things, the heavens. But time, the ages, just roll over the work that she has done. They break it, they destroy it. The stumbling ages over her labor pass. It's been going on for so long, and still no great transforming light came down, and no revealing rapture touched her fall. Only a glimmer, a faint glimmer of light, sometimes splits the sky of mind, justifying the ambiguous providence that makes of night a path to unknown dawns, or a dark clue to some diviner state. Sounds like rain, no? There's an ambiguous providence. Providence, this word refers to the divine plan and the divine care for each and every being in his creation. We can't understand the divine providence. For us, it's mystifying, ambiguous, because it makes night, it makes darkness and ignorance and suffering a path to unknown dawns. It's one of the wonderful things I feel I have learnt from Savitri, that every night gives birth to a dawn. And the darker the night, the more beautiful the dawn. The poem begins with the obstruction of darkness, darkness of all kinds on all levels, obstructing the coming of the dawn. And the poem closes with the image of night transformed by the work that Savitri has done, nursing in her bosom a greater dawn than any that has come before. But it's difficult for us to understand that when we're fumbling about in the darkness. But that we can think that this darkness is a clue. It's a thread that's leading us to some diviner state. So this creative force of life cast down into the world of matter, her mighty task, she has to begin in nescience, in a state without knowledge. But she does progress towards ignorance, to half-knowing. And there, in that state of half-knowing, she pursues that unfinished work, that work that she has been given. She gropes for knowledge. When we can't see, we grope. No? We try to feel our way. But she's not able to meet the face of wisdom, of true knowledge. But still, she goes on ascending upwards, slowly, with unconscious steps, driven by instinct and that deeper knowledge within. Here in our world, she wanders as a foundling of the God. It's also such a poignant word. A foundling is an abandoned child, a lost child, a child who's been deliberately abandoned and who has been found. She's a child of the God. She's a divine child. But she's been cast down here into matter. So here she's wandering, longing for some faint memory she has of her true home. Here she's like a child soul left near the gates of hell, fumbling through fog in search of paradise. She has that faint memory of paradise. She knows that's where she belongs. But here she is. She's just been abandoned near the gates of the lowest, most polluted levels of vital consciousness. And there she is, groping her way, fumbling. It's the same image. You're fumbling. You can't make your hands do what you want them to do. Very, very poignant image.
Mm. I have a question. The journey from the hell to heaven, in the beginning is harder and harder, and it gets easier and easier, or you can make the progress at the lower level faster, and then it gets difficult.
I don't know. Sri Aurobindo writes, of course, we will read it soon in Canto 7. He says that if the pilgrim soul wants to reach heaven, it has to pass very close to the gates of hell. And he speaks of the dangers of that state and how to avoid them. We'll see when we come there. You like to read? Thank you. So this is King Aswapati. As she moves slowly up with unconscious steps, he must follow her pace. This is King Aswapati. He's the traveler of the worlds. We are following him through these different levels of consciousness.
What's death's food?
Perhaps we all eat death's food. We wouldn't eat anything living. Oh, some people do, of course. But the thing is that in order to follow the steps of life, he has to see where was her starting point. He has to go right back to that origin, which was just mentioned very briefly at the end of Canto 3. Can you repeat it? Can you repeat it, Uma?
Mother says when there is no progress in our life.
There is no what?
Progress.
Progress.
Yes. Then it's mentioned as death.
Yes.
So here the death's eight death's food is that which is not fruitful of living.
Yes. Yes. We have to, you know, so she was It says even to feed death with her works is here life's doom on page 131. You know, she just gets swallowed up, all her glory into littleness turned. So veiled was her immortality that she seemed inflicting consciousness on conscious things. That's exactly what we see her doing here, no? But she seems in this state to be only an episode in an eternal death. The whole material universe can be seen like that, as a nothing but an eternal death. And so in this material world, life seems to be something mythic, mythic being. And it may appear as an illusion for a short time, but eventually it must forever cease. This is the evil mystery of the change that has come over the life force as she's swallowed up in matter. And now Asvapati wants to go back to that moment of swallowing up, to see where she's gone and how and why, from the very first faint and dim subconscious start. He says that's the only way to bring about the salvation of the earth, because this is the only way that Asvapati can understand the obscure cause of all the obstacles that we experience in our further progress. All that holds us back, everything, he says, that baffles God in the jail delivery of the imprisoned soul. God wants to set free this soul that's imprisoned in matter, but he's baffled. There's something that's preventing him from doing that. And that seems to be this problem of the unconscious life. No? Here in this realm, at this stage which he's seeing now, life was intimate with death and night. She's living in their world, and she has to eat their food so that she can live, breathe for a little while. It's as if they've adopted her. There she is, abandoned, this child soul abandoned near the gates of hell, and death and night have adopted her. She's their adopted waif. They are looking after her for the time being.
Does food also reference pomegranate seeds?
Paula's referring to the legend of Persephone, the glorious harbinger of spring, of new life. But she's been captured by the god of death, the god of the underworld. And her mother, her divine mother of creative life and fertility, comes looking for her. She's told that while Persephone was in the realm of death, she has eaten 6 pomegranate seeds. And so, since she's eaten death's food, she can never again be truly free to live in the upper world. He will allow her to go there, be with her mother, to enjoy the delights of earth, only for 6 months in the year. And the other 6 months she has to spend with him in the dark lower regions. So it may be an allusion, as you suggest. Yeah. So many allusions to Greek mythology in this poem.
But in agenda was explaining about the food. When you're eating food, she said, I'm not eating so much. Very, very little, but food is death. Hello? It's true.
We have to eat a little food of death just to breathe a while, to keep ourselves alive for the time being. When the substance, the bodily substance, the living substance is fully transformed, then it won't be necessary anymore.
Only drinking the end of his experiments in the life.
Pomegranate, though, is the vine and love spreading over the world as a community.
Divine love is the pomegranate flower, and she told a beautiful story about that. But we won't go into that now. Sorry? Divine sacrifice, yes. And the story is about sacrifice.
Is it Krishna?
But if the divine love has to go down into the pit of hell, otherwise we won't have transformation.
Right, exactly. So, come, Mariyash. She has to. Oh, this is where we start reading again. Yes. You like to read, ma'am? Accepting subconscious. Oh, yes, sorry. Accepting subconscious. In dumb darkness reign, a sojourner. She's staying there temporarily, but she no longer has any hope. There, far away from truth and luminous thought, Asvapati saw the original seat, the separate birth of the dethroned, deformed, and suffering power, what life becomes. And we will also see this dethroned, deformed, and suffering power in Canto 8. Sorry, please go on. An unhappy face.
An unhappy face of falsity made to a contradiction of our divine birth, indifferent to beauty and to light, parading she flaunted her animal disgrace, unhelped by camouflage, brutal and bare, an authentic image recognized and signed of her outcast foes, exiled from heaven and hope, fallen glorying in the vileness of her state, a grovel of her strength, once half divine, a graceless squalor of her beast desires, the starry visage of her ignorance, the naked body of her poverty. Here first she crawled, and from her cabin of mud, where she had lain inconscient, rigid, mute, its narrowness and torpor held her still, a darkness a darkness clung to her unappeased by light. There near no touch redeeming from above, the upward look was alien to her sight. Forgotten she fearless, godhead of her walk, renounced was the glory and felicity. The adventure in the dangerous fields of time, hardly she availed, willing to bear and live.
Yes. Yes. Yes, you know, the life goddess in her original state, she has no fear of anything, no. And she's a very, very powerful, a creative force, no.
Just like the purpose,
Godhead means that her origin is divine.
Yes. So.
And where is the line? Yes. So in this state, which is described in this section, the previous section was about Asvapati's perception of this plane or level where life is just emerging from matter. But now he feels that in order to understand this process and perhaps be able to do something about it, he has to go back to the source. he has to start, go right back to this faint and dim subconscious start. So in the rest of this section, what we get is a kind of evocation, a description of that very first beginning of emergence of life, imprisoned in matter, in which she's lost all her divine qualities, and she's hardly alive. She almost can't bear that state. She's hardly alive. It's terrible, really. And we shall have to enter into this realm in more detail ourselves and see in more detail what King Aswapati sees. Here it's just touched on for a moment, the state that subconscious life imprisoned in the death of matter, death and unconsciousness of matter. And then in the next section we get a slight new step. I think we have read it, no? You'd like to read, Gunilla? From the break?
I'm going to of speaking space. Rainless region, swallowed in
swathes.
Swathes. That seem unnamed, unbodied, unhoused. Swallowed visionless, a formless mind. Housed for a body to translate its soul. Strayed in life, crumpled up the thought. As yet not power to think, or meant to be. Broken into a weird and pitiable world. But this unhappy matter has its source. On the incompliance where life and matter met. She wandered along in things, both seen and off guessed, pursued by the public vast beginnings and lost ends. There life was born, but dark before it could live. There was no solid ground, no constant place, only some plane for mindless wind, the power.
Thank you. Oh, this is what King Aswapati experiences and sees. Sri Aurobindo must have been there and must have experienced it. That's how he can tell us about it. It's a formless space, a wide, unquiet mist of seeking space. There is some seeking, some searching. He says, lower down where we stopped, there's some flame of mindless will working there. But it's a rayless region. There's no light. It's swallowed up in vague swathes of mist, thick mist. And that region seemed, it doesn't have a name, it doesn't have a body, it doesn't have a house, a home, a place that belongs to it. It seems like a swaddled, visionless, and formless mind. A bodiless mind doesn't have a form, it doesn't have any power of vision, and it's swaddled. Swaddling is what used to be done to newborn babies. They were afraid that the limbs would get deformed, and so they wrapped them up tightly in bandages. I don't know how long they kept them like that. So something that's swaddled, it can't move. It's tightly wrapped up. But in that state of being wrapped up, unable to move, there is some seeking, and that is asking for a body, a form, to translate its soul, to give some expression to the soul within. But it's not allowed to have that body. Its prayer is denied. So that seeking fumbled again. It's trying to reach something like thought, to some consciousness. But as yet, it's not empowered to think. It's hardly allowed to live. No, hardly she availed to bear and live. So that seeking opens up into a weird and pygmy world, a world where everything is very deformed and tiny. That's where this unhappy magic had its source, the unhappy magic of the deformation of life. And Asvapati is wandering there. He's wandering on these dim, shadowy confines, these borderlines where life and matter meet. He wandered among things half seen, half guessed. He can't see them properly, so he guesses. He's pursued by ungrasped beginnings. Things seem to begin, but they don't really begin, and they seem to end, but the endings are lost. In this state, at this level, life was born but died before it could live. There must have been a stage like this in the emergence of life, where little currents of life force could emerge and then disappear again. There was no solid ground, no constant drift, no direction, but there is some flame of mindless will that has some power. Anmol, will you read?
Himself was dim to himself, half felt, obscure, as if in a struggle of the void to be, in strange domains where all was living sense, but mastering thought was not, nor cause, nor rule, only a crude child heart crying for toys of bliss, mind flicker, a disorder infant glow, and random shapeless energies drove towards form and took each wisp fire for a guiding sun. This blindfold force could place no thinking step, asking for a light, she followed darkness's clue, and inconscient power groped towards consciousness. Matter, smitten by matter, glimmered to sense, blind contacts, slow reactions beat out sparks of instinct from a cloaked subliminal bed. Sensations crowded, dumb substitutes for thought, perception answered nature's wakening blows, but still was a mechanical response, a jerk, a leap, a start in nature's dream, and rude, unchastened impulses jostling ran, heedless of every motion but their own, and darkling clashed with darker than themselves, free in a world of settled anarchy.
Thank you. I think this life level must still exist in our bodies. I think I'll just read to the end of the section. The need to exist, the instinct to survive, engrossed the tense, precarious moment's will, and an unseeing desire felt out for food. The gusts of nature were the only law. Force wrestled with force, but no result remained. Only were achieved a nescient grasp and drive, and feelings and instincts knowing not their source. Sense pleasures and sense pangs soon caught, soon lost, and the brute motion of unthinking life. It was a vain, unnecessary world whose will to be brought poor and sad results and meaningless suffering and a grey unease. Nothing seemed worth the labour to become. But the first line of the next section says, but judged not so, his spirit's wakened eye. So we'll look at that next week. Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.